coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. Pro-Russian rebels and Ukraine's military are both refusing to pull back their weapons from a strategic eastern Ukrainian town. The fighting continues there despite an internationally brokered ceasefire. The UN Human Rights Office says it's very alarmed by reports that thousands of civilians are trapped in the Ukrainian city of Debaltseve. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Human Rights Office says it has not managed to get reliable information on the fighting or casualties in the Debaltseve area, but expresses alarm at reports of continued shelling and says it believes a few thousand civilians are hiding in cellars. Spokesman Rupert Colville says it is not clear how many civilians are hiding, but says they are struggling to get food, water, and other basic necessities. Colville notes in the days leading up to the ceasefire, hostilities intensified with numerous military and civilian casualties. He says casualties decreased dramatically during the first 2 days of the ceasefire, which began February 15. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United Nations Human Rights Chief is calling on Libyans to overcome crippling political divisions that have fractured the country and unite against extremism in the wake of the grisly revelation that Islamic State militants beheaded 21 Christian Egyptian workers there. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, however, is turning to the United Nations to take the lead, asking the UN Security Council on Tuesday to adopt a resolution calling for international military intervention in Libya. This is VOA News. Provincial officials said a group of suicide bombers attacked a police station in eastern Afghanistan on Tuesday. At least 22 officers were killed and 18 others were wounded. One attacker blew himself up at the gate of the headquarters in Puli Alam, about 60 kilometers south of the capital, Kabul, according to provincial government spokesman Dean Mohammad Darwish. The latest insurgent violence came as top Afghan security officials from across the country gathered in Kabul Tuesday to discuss key counterinsurgency measures. UN Commander of the International Forces General John Campbell spoke at the session.
Without your professionalism, your enthusiasm, and your diligence, the people in your province will suffer and will neither respect nor support you. We will continue to support you for many, many more years.
U.S. General John Campbell. Pakistani authorities said a powerful suicide bomb went off just outside police headquarters in the eastern city of Lahore Tuesday, killing at least five people and wounding many more. Witnesses described the explosion as so powerful that they were knocked to the ground. The injured are being transferred to nearby hospitals. Rescue operations are underway and police have surrounded the area. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is vowing to protect complete religious freedom in his country. From New Delhi, Anjana Pasricha has a report.
Speaking at an event organized by the Christian community in New Delhi to celebrate the beatification of two Indians, Prime Minister Narendra Modi strongly condemned violence targeting religious minorities and vowed to protect them.
I appeal to all religious groups to act with restraint, mutual respect and tolerance in the true spirit of this ancient nation.
Mr. Modi's comments were seen as a bid to reassure religious minorities amid criticism that his government, led by the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, has not done enough to stem religious tensions that have surfaced since it came to power last May. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Bomb attacks were reported at three different locations in Nigeria Tuesday amid rising tensions caused by the coming elections and Boko Haram insurgency. In the first reported attack, a VOA Hausa Service reporter says multiple blasts hit a military checkpoint in Bue in northeastern Borno State. According to local media, two suicide bombers riding a three-wheel vehicle were stopped at an entry checkpoint where they dismounted their vehicle and detonated their explosives. Danish media report the Copenhagen man who attacked a free speech seminar last weekend swore allegiance to the Islamic State. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
We have registered the arrival of almost 4,000 people in just 4 days starting last Friday in southern Europe. Those are people who are fleeing from Libya. They are mainly sub-Saharan migrants. There were some Somalis and about 100 Syrians today. And they are rescued mainly by the Italian Coast Guard with the support of other vessels, one Italian Navy vessel and a commercial ship.
That's Flavio Di Giacomo of the International Organization for Migration. Details coming up.
Also in the news, in northeast Nigeria, insurgent group Boko Haram has distributed leaflets warning people to boycott the March 28th nationwide elections.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Kenya, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, weeks before crucial national elections, former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo said today he has quit the ruling party of Nigeria. Obasanjo has been a major figure in the People's Democratic Party. He also has been critical of President Goodluck Jonathan's efforts to contain the five-year insurgency of Islamist radicals of Boko Haram. Jonathan is running for re-election against Muhammadu Buhari of the opposition All Progressive Congress, APC. Buhari was military ruler in the 1980s and is seen as tough on security and corruption. Obasanjo endorsed Buhari in a published interview last week. Obasanjo told local reporters today he is ready to work with anybody regardless of his or her political affiliation. Nigeria's elections were delayed due to the violence which has spread into the region in recent months.
In related news from West Africa, the Prime Minister of Niger led a crowd of thousands in Niamey, the nation's capital, to protest the deadly raids of Boko Haram insurgents from across the Nigerian border. When they reached the parliament building, President Mahamadou Issoufou met the demonstrators and told them Niger will be the tomb of the radical Islamists. A large number of Boko Haram fighters attacked the town of Difa a week ago. Mr. Issoufou said nobody attacks Niger without punishment.
In northeast Nigeria, insurgent group Boko Haram has distributed leaflets warning people to boycott the March 28th nationwide elections. But that is not the only threat to security. VOA's Anne Look reports people are moving their families away from sites of possible tension around the country and are preparing for unrest once results are announced.
From the Niger Delta to the far northeast, the pre-election period has become a time of migration for some Nigerians. VOA met several on the streets of Kaduna.
My wife has been pestering me for the past 3 months. Even today she called to say, are we ready to move?
Nobody wants to die for nothing. So I myself, I'm even planning to relocate to a certain part of Kaduna where I will not be hearing sound of war, drums of crisis, burning of tires and tear gas and all those kind of stuff. I don't want to see all those rubbish.
If before the elections they are already tearing posters, you know, burning cars, injuring people, and are already being violent before the election, that anything can happen either during or after the elections.
Nigeria's last nationwide vote in 2011 was praised as more credible than any before it. But more than 1,000 people were killed, most of them during post-election violence, and mostly in Kaduna State, where politics sparked sectarian and communal tensions. The 2015 elections are shaping up to be the most hotly contested in Nigeria's democratic history. President Goodluck Jonathan and the ruling PDP party are facing a strong challenge from the opposition APC and its candidate, former military ruler Muhammadu Buhari. Voters are nervous about the post-election period.
To take our time, we'll go and vote and we'll stay back and inside our houses and we'll look on how the election and the outcome of it will be. But certainly we have to go and vote.
Nigeria's police chief issued a statement this month trying to reassure voters and calling for them to stop relocating. But the pre-election incidents have been piling up. Party headquarters have been bombed or vandalized. Opposition supporters say they have been attacked in River State. A suicide bomber blew herself up in Gombe as President Goodluck Jonathan finished his rally there. Nigeria's National Human Rights Commission says at least 58 people have been killed in pre-election violence since December. Lagos, Kaduna, and Rivers State, it says, have had the most incidents. Nigeria's Electoral Commission postponed the polls by 6 weeks to March 28th after security forces said they needed more time to fight Boko Haram in the northeast and ensure voting is safe. Anne Look, VOA News, Dakar.
A group of leading international scientists has called for greater speed in making new Ebola vaccines available, citing fears that the virus disease can become endemic in West Africa. The scientists said the potential for that to happen is a real and very concerning possibility. The team of 26 scientists made their views known in a statement released today by the Wellcome Trust. It's the largest medical charity in the United Kingdom. The trust's director, Jeremy Farrar, said, despite falling infection rates in Africa, the current Ebola outbreak may not be brought under complete control. In the last 11 months, more than 23,000 people have contracted the virus and 9,300 people have died. Farrar called current efforts to control the virus remarkable, but added it is essential to find a preventative vaccine in months rather than years.
Well, several experimental vaccines are being tested in several countries, but the Wellcome Trust announced the suspension of test of one vaccine when the manufacturer Chimerix stopped making it. The trust now says commercial vaccine manufacturing is not a good fit for meeting the need to rapidly develop and deploy new vaccines. The trust joined with the University of Minnesota's Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy to form the team of scientists to monitor global efforts to find an Ebola vaccine.
Ebola survivors in Sierra Leone are helping to train healthcare workers by showing them what to expect when dealing with Ebola patients. The training is a partnership between the International Organization for Migration, IOM, the World Health Organization, and the Sierra Leone Ministry of Health and Sanitation. Nina De Vries has more from Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown.
The training takes place in a stadium downtown. A mock hospital has been set up so people get a real sense of being at work.
Praise him for what he has done, great and mighty things.
Some Ebola survivors find great comfort in a song they wrote, thanking God they are still alive. They sing it when they meet for a panel discussion with healthcare workers going through training. Marina Sharif is one of those people. She caught Ebola from a local doctor.
And I want to make people say Ebola. Yeah, because at one time...
Speaking in her native Creole language, she says, I want to make people know Ebola is real, because when it started, people were in denial about it. They did not believe it existed. But it does exist. And that's why it's so important for healthcare workers to be prepared, says Yasmin Kande, the training supervisor with IOM. She says it's crucial for them to know how to properly put on and take off their protective gear. The virus is spread through contact with an infected person's bodily fluids, and patients often experience vomiting and diarrhea, so the slightest slip-up can turn healthcare workers into patients themselves. The workers are also taught what behavior to expect from Ebola patients, says Kande.
Patients who are delirious, confused, and these are some of the major challenges that crop up in the Ebola treatment units or centers, and we just want to prepare the health workers to be able to manage such challenges efficiently and compassionately.
Deanna Garda is a certified nurse and midwife who works in Seattle and is one of the people who went through the training. Garda says the mock treatment center was especially helpful.
They had little scenarios like there are needles on the ground, and we would walk in and then he would say, okay, I just want you to look at your feet. And we'd look down and there'd be sharps on the ground, and he would say, you need to be looking at everything when you walk in. And that has totally helped me because that sort of thing happens when it gets really, really busy.
She adds that as challenging and busy as her time has been, it will be hard to leave especially as she has been able to witness people overcome Ebola.
You do make connections, and I think that we've done some really great things, and we've had people that we thought were not going to make it that have walked out on their own 2 feet. So we've had some incredible successes, and sometimes women will come back and they'll visit us, and that's always a really good feeling.
Okay, that's good. And what else do you want to do for the patient? It's permitting.
The training can also be helpful to Ebola survivors themselves, as many face stigma and are shunned. Survivor Fonte Cargbo caught Ebola from his wife. She did not survive, and neither did his children. Now he's completely alone. He says coming to work every day to train the healthcare workers and doing something positive helps keep him going.
Since I started coming here, at least by interacting with people, talking about my own story and all the rest of it, it makes me at least to forget a little, but it's not really easy.
The training with Ebola survivors began last November. Similar training is occurring in Liberia and Guinea, the other countries heavily affected by the disease. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The International Organization for Migration reports at least 3,800 migrants were rescued from the Mediterranean Sea since Friday. And in northeast Nigeria, insurgent group Boko Haram has distributed leaflets warning people to boycott the March 28th nationwide elections. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi says the United Nations Security Council should adopt a resolution calling for international military intervention in Libya. Mr. Sisi's comments came in an interview with France's Europe One Radio. They came a day after Egyptian forces carried out airstrikes targeting Islamic State militants in the eastern Libyan city of Darna. Those bombings were retaliation for the militants' beheading of 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians. The beheadings were the latest example of the chaos that has persisted in Libya. Parallel governments and warring militias are struggling for control 4 years after the death of former leader Muammar Gaddafi. The International Organization for Migration, IOM, reports at least 3,800 migrants were rescued from the Mediterranean Sea since Friday. The organization warns that Italy's current rescue system called Triton, which patrols the Mediterranean off the coast of Italy, is not adequate in the face of this emergency situation. The IOM says what is needed now is to immediately establish a rescue system on the high seas that can effectively save migrants off the coast of Libya. Flavio Di Giacomo is a spokesperson for IOM Italy. He provided us with an update on the latest rescue operation from the Mediterranean.
We have registered the arrival of almost 4,000 people in just 4 days, starting last Friday, in southern Europe. Those are people who are fleeing from Libya. They are mainly sub-Saharan migrants. There were some Somalis and about 100 Syrians today. And they are rescued mainly by the Italian Coast Guard with the support of other vessels, one Italian Navy vessel and commercial ships. They are being brought to Lampedusa and to the other ports in southern Italy, especially in Sicily and in Calabria. And now the migrants are being identified and then transferred to the main reception centers in Italy, which at the moment are starting to be full. So it's kind of emergency, of course, from the operational point of view. We think that the mechanism of search and rescue, which is currently active in the Mediterranean, Triton, is not adequate because it just works 30 miles off the Italian coast, while the majority of these rescue operations are carried out in international waters. So The Italian Coast Guard now has the burden to carry out the majority of this operation, but it cannot do it. And these people need to be saved and to be rescued because, of course, they are fleeing from a very dangerous situation.
Are the majority of them coming from Libya?
They're all coming from Libya. There are no Libyans, of course. There are only migrants from sub-Saharan or other regions, no Libyans. They are coming from the coastal Libyan coastal areas. They told us that they are kept in so-called connection houses for hours or even days sometimes. And then the smugglers, when they gather the group, they force them to leave even if the situation of the sea is very harsh, is very rough, and the vessels that they are using, they are very unworthy. In this situation, migrants, they don't have any choice to change their mind. Once you pay, you cannot go back, so they told us several times. And even now, they told us that they are threatened with guns and sticks and forced to get on board. But as a matter of fact, they told us that the situation in Libya is unlivable, it's very dangerous, they cannot even walk in the street. These are people that needs to be supported, and we are expecting more people to arrive in the next few days, given what is happening now in Libya.
What countries are they coming from to arrive in Libya, and are they going there for work?
Well, you know, there are some people who, from the beginning, they left their country of origin in order to reach Europe. But there are also people who have been living in Libya for a while, even for years, and they speak Arabic. The migrants who are arriving these days are mainly sub-Saharan. I'm talking about Gambia, Niger, Senegal, Mali, these nationalities. But there are also some Somalis and some Syrians. But the majority are sub-Saharan, and some of them, they just wanted to come to Europe. For them, Libya was a country of transit, but for others, Libya was their current home. But now the situation has become unlivable, so they decided that they have no other options but to leave.
With the reception centers reaching capacity with the huge influx of migrants, what are they doing with people to try to accommodate them?
There are many reception centers in Italy. Since last year, we have registered the arrival of so many migrants. The Italian government established an emergency system of reception centers in all of the country, from the south to the north. So these people now are being brought to the ports in southern Italy, but then they will be soon transferred to these reception facilities, even in northern Italy, which can be reception centers, but sometimes even hotels or schools which are not used. There are many reception facilities, but of course the situation is going to be very, very difficult because, as far as we know, all these facilities now are starting to be full. For example, the center of Lampedusa is overwhelmed with people. There are 1,000 people now, and the reception facilities of the center is 400 people. So the situation may become complicated in this sense.
Also, I understand that you are still receiving chilling details of some of the boats that departed Libya over a week ago with people drowning. And I understand that the Triton, the rescue system, is doing the best that it can do.
Yes, we are receiving these testimonies, but the point is that the people who have been rescued last week, the survivors of the shipwrecks which happened last week, were people who were rescued by the Italian Coast Guard because they were rescued 100 miles off the Italian coast, where the Triton units do not work. We think that Triton, yes, is doing the best that they can do, but they are not in the right place because they are just walking 30 miles off the Italian coast, while these shipwrecks happened very close to the Libyan coastal areas. So we think that the system is completely inadequate and not sufficient to cope with this kind of situation. Triton must be expanded in terms of geographical limitation, but also in terms of means.
That was Flavio Di Giacomo, the spokesperson for IOM Italy. He spoke with me from Rome.
HIV infections are on the rise among people in Africa who inject illegal drugs. A new report recommends scaling up programs designed to prevent the spread of the AIDS virus among drug users. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
The head of Harm Reduction International says unsafe injecting drug use is a major driver of HIV/AIDS worldwide.
Traditionally, we've seen regions such as Eurasia and Asia and the Middle East and North Africa sort of be epicenters of a lot of injecting drug use and a lot of unsafe injecting drug use. And so we see very high rates of HIV amongst people who inject drugs in those countries. But in recent years, researchers and community health organizations in a number of sub-Saharan African countries have also begun to document an increase.
Rick Lyne says there are new and emerging patterns of injecting drug use in such places as Tanzania, Zanzibar, Uganda, Senegal, and Kenya.
Of course, sub-Saharan Africa is a region of the world which has been disproportionately affected by HIV across the board, as we've known since the beginning of the epidemic. That has largely been driven by sexual transmission. So HIV transmission via injecting drug use in the region is something quite new. Our research would estimate that perhaps up to 1 million people are injecting drugs in various countries in that part of the world.
Lyne says the increase in injecting drug use in sub-Saharan Africa is connected to a change in drug trafficking routes. The drugs pass through the continent on their way to Western Europe. The Global State of Harm Reduction 2014 report calls for an increase in programs to help drug users. One such program is called OST, or Opioid Substitution Therapy.
Most people would probably be familiar with a medicine called methadone. Opioid substitution therapy is essentially a medical intervention whereby people who are dependent upon illicit opiates, most usually heroin, people who are injecting heroin, for example, can switch to drugs such as methadone, which are pharmaceutical prescription drugs administered by physicians or health clinics.
Methadone is taken orally. It's been in wide use in the United States, Western Europe, and Australia. Another way to help stop the spread of HIV among injecting drug users is the Needle or Syringe Exchange Program, or NSP. Lyne says it, too, has been in use for decades.
We know that the main risk of HIV transmission via injecting drug use is people sharing syringes. So one of the early interventions in what we call the harm reduction approach or HIV prevention approach was to set up programs whereby we have outreach workers going out and working with people who inject drugs and ensuring that if they're going to be injecting, that they're actually injecting with sterile equipment rather than sharing equipment.
He says needle exchange programs are widely credited with reducing HIV infection rates in Western Europe and Australia in the late 1980s. The Global State of Harm Reduction report says Malaysia, Iran, and Australia have seen the steepest increase in needle and syringe exchange programs. There's been an increase in high-risk injecting practices reported in Tanzania and Zanzibar. One example is called flash blood. It's when someone injects himself with blood taken from another person who already has an injection of heroin. Nearly 7 million people in sub-Saharan Africa are receiving antiretroviral therapy to either treat or prevent HIV infection. Lyne says few of them are injecting drug users.
Unfortunately, it's the case across the world that people who are drug users are largely left outside that otherwise successful approach. The estimates that are usually used in United Nations documents is that about 4% of people who are drug users who are living with HIV or accessing antiretroviral therapies.
Part of the reason for that, he says, is stigma.
There's a general assumption that people who are drug users are somehow not going to be compliant with the drug regime, but all the evidence that's been done to date shows that that's clearly not the case.
Lyne says that the harm reduction approach can be implemented in many different socioeconomic, cultural, and political environments.
In recent years, we've seen very, very successful projects being established in parts of Eurasia, Central and Eastern Europe, certain countries in the Middle East, in North Africa. Now we're starting to see very effective programs being developed in parts of sub-Saharan Africa.
He says even though opioid substitution therapy and needle exchange programs are low cost, there's a big funding gap. He says UNAIDS estimates more than $2.3 billion is needed annually for HIV prevention among people who inject drugs. Lyne says only about $200 million of that is actually provided. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 17:30 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top story this hour. The International Organization for Migration reports at least 3,800 migrants were rescued from the Mediterranean Sea since Friday. Coming up, we'll have music from Kenya. And in our feature segment, the U.S. pays tribute to African Americans each February by recalling the history of African Americans. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya Swuhi, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're beginning with disabled sports in Uganda.
Kim, let's begin in Uganda, where the disabled often face more than physical challenges. But this is slowly changing for Uganda's Wheelchair Basketball Association. The aim is to keep these athletes fit, both physically and mentally, while instilling a sense of pride. Reporter Elizabeth Pola has more from their recent tournament in the capital, Kampala.
At one of Kampala's major sports expositions, fans are gathered for an event most have never seen before. Men and women in wheelchairs playing basketball. This game will be a fast and furious match between the Rebels and the Nakaseros, as athletes speed across the court, vying for the ball. For many disabled Ugandans, life is incredibly hard. A lack of accessible buildings, transport, and activities means that the disabled end up spending most of their time at home. But for those joining Uganda's parasport teams, life has changed immensely. Joan Naguja, a volunteer with Uganda's Paralympic Committee, explains how she found self-confidence through sports.
So they affected my left hand side a little bit, so my hand and leg are paralyzed.
She says that because her hand and leg are paralyzed, she felt self-conscious. But when she grew up, she looked for ways to challenge herself, and she discovered sports, and that changed how she felt about herself. She was no longer afraid to talk to people, and she now feels proud. The Uganda Disabled Basketball Association began in the northern town of Gulu in 2007 and now has teams across the country. Their goal is to expand their reach internationally. In coming months, the association hopes to travel to Somalia to train teams, and there's talk of an international match between Uganda and Kenya. Their coach, Edwin Malima, who used to play basketball on Uganda's national team, says he had to learn how to play in a chair when he became their coach. The team uses special sport wheelchairs for quick maneuvers and to prevent falls. However, Malima says it wasn't always this way.
At first, we had the worst wheelchairs, but what was it, Lions Gate? Lions Club.
He says it was very tough in the beginning with old-style wheelchairs, which were hard to control and players would often fall. He says that changed after the Lions Club China donated new wheelchairs, which make maneuvering around the court much easier. Along with the Basketball Association, there are disabled sports associations for rowing, amputee football, and swimming. Although they are part of Uganda's Paralympic Committee, they receive very little funding from the government, relying on NGOs for funds. The associations are hoping that as their groups expand across East Africa, so will their budgets. Elizabeth Pola, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Thanks, Elizabeth. From Kampala, let's go north to Juba, South Sudan's capital. That's where the local football club, Malakia, lost to Nigeria's Kano Pillars 2-0 over the weekend in a first-leg preliminary round match in the CAF Champions League tournament. Magumi Davis-Wakarinje attended the game at Juba Stadium, and he has this report for us.
The excitement was palpable
at Juba Stadium as South Sudan's Malakia FC put up a spirited fight against Kano Pillars in the first round of the African Club Champions League. Bashir Edlis Mwazu, chairman of the Kano Pillars Football Club, says he was delighted to be in Juba for the match.
I enjoy my stay in South Sudan, so I would be happy one day to come back and live in South Sudan.
Football fan Ramze Sagam, a second-year medical student at Juba University, was happy to be at the game.
I could see the fans of Nigeria could really boost their players, and I could also see the fans of Malakia really boosting their players as well. This seems to have been the first international match I've watched between my team from South Sudan and a team from outside, so I really feel so excited.
Nigeria's Gambo Mohammed earned the first goal of the game just 4 minutes after the start of the second half. But local fans were not yet ready to give up. Even when Christian Obiazo kicked a cracker 63 minutes into the match, fans like Sagam believe South Sudan can still qualify for the next round when the two teams meet again during the second leg in Nigeria.
We can win there, because if you could see, it's just a couple of mistakes that has really led to our loss. If at all we actually manage to pull our socks up, we shall be able to beat the Nigerian team from their home.
Malakia Football Club coach Ramze Sebit says Sagam is right.
No impossible under the sun, but there are some difficulties. I accept it, but I never surrender, because I take this example from our hero, Dr. John Garang Dimavio. We are never surrender, and I have a hope.
He blamed the loss on extremely enthusiastic fans who may have made his still inexperienced players nervous. He says his young team is not used to such applause, and they have uphill battle. South Sudan is ranked 147 places below Nigeria in the latest FIFA rankings. But Liluanu Idris Malekawa, media relations officer for the Nigerian team, says South Sudan is just learning how to perform on the international stage.
They are very hospitality, and I'm telling you, when they come to Kano, Nigeria, they will see how we are going to repeat the same hospitality to them. We are very grateful.
And fans like 24-year-old Banan Fok, who plays for rival club Al Hilal, say South Sudan players and fans can hold their heads high.
So, yes, I'm here to support my second team, Al Malakia Juba. Because I'm South Sudanese, I'm just supporting the team because of we are the same nation and the same country.
For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
Just ahead, my VOA colleague James Buddy we'll have a birthday Black History Month segment about the man many call the greatest basketball player of all time.
On this day in 1963, Michael Jeffrey Jordan was born in New York City. Jordan was one of the most effectively marketed athletes of his generation and was instrumental in popularizing the NBA around the world in the 1980s and 1990s. He holds the NBA record for highest career regular season scoring average with 30.12 points per game, as well as averaging a record 33.4 points per game in the NBA playoffs.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on The Voice of America. It's time now to announce the two lucky winners to our recent Nations Cup quiz put forth by our African football guru, David Legg. David's quiz question: which countries have won the Nations Cup tournament without conceding a goal? Once again, that question: which countries have won the Nations Cup tournament without conceding a goal? And in case you're wondering about the 2015 champion Ivory Coast, which lifted the trophy on February 8th in Bata, Equatorial Guinea, well, the Elephants gave up a total of four goals, two in the group stage, one in the quarterfinals. That was a 3-1 victory over Algeria. And another goal in the semifinals. That was another 3-1 victory over the Democratic Republic of Congo. In the final, Ivory Coast defeated Ghana 9-8 on penalty kicks after 120 minutes of scoreless football. Now, penalty kicks do not count in the goal aggregate for the competition. The correct answer to David Legg's Nations Cup quiz is Ivory Coast in 1992 and Cameroon in 2002. Both teams won the final on penalty kicks, but did not concede any goals during regulation and extra time play. And our two winners both hail from Nigeria. Congratulations to Nwoke Chuks in Abuja, Nigeria's political capital. And congratulations also to Andrew Obumneme in Awka, the capital of Nigeria's Anambra State. Andrew and Nwoke, you'll both be receiving some of those delightful VOA goodies. So watch your mailbox and stay tuned to all our Voice of America listeners for David Legg's next African football quiz question.
This is the Voice of America. Washington, D.C.
The Voice of America.
Hello, everybody. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the Voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady Voice of America.
Voice of America!
And thank you, President Obama, for your support of the Voice of America. An update now on the Cricket World Cup, which is being co-hosted by Australia and New Zealand. The Black Caps from New Zealand scored their second straight victory Tuesday when they beat Scotland by 3 wickets at University Oval in Dunedin. New Zealand cricketer Trent Bolt, a left-arm, medium-fast opening bowler and a right-handed batsman, was named the player of the match. The final score from Dunedin, New Zealand 146 for 7 in 24.5 overs. Scotland 142 in 36.2 overs. Neighbors South Africa and Zimbabwe are representing Africa at the Cricket World Cup. They played each other Sunday in their opening match in Hamilton, New Zealand, where the South Africans won by 62 runs. And let's give a big shout-out for South Africa's David Miller and J.P. Duminy. They combined for 253 runs in that match, with Miller tallying 138 and Domini 115. Taking a look at the Cricket World Cup calendar, Zimbabwe will next be in action on Thursday against the United Arab Emirates in Nelson, New Zealand. And South Africa plays its next match February 22nd against India in Melbourne, Australia. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, United States pays tribute to African Americans each February by recalling the history of African Americans. And next, trying to understand the so-called Ugandan English or Uglish. But first, some music. Here is Kenya Sila with Africa. Thank you.
yo como moyo yo. Oh, inside yet tap on the stop and I'm wingin' it, sit up and I'm wingin' it. Send away, this one go. And your ribbon cuckoo watch and I see where it's yeah. Cause me mini wako, when you want go away, yeah. Freaka, freaka, freaka mama, yeah. Oh, freaka, freaka, freaka mama, yeah. Yeah, bizu wangu yo. Kilala sipati usingizi mama, yeah. Umeniacha, umeniacha na majuzi mingi mama, yeah. Kupenda siku zote yeye. Sitaki mwingine yeye. Leo mimi sijali, sijali kweli sijali yeye. Kwa mimi ni wako, uni wangu yeye.
With Africa.
Well, the United States pays tribute to African Americans each February by recalling the history of African Americans. One page of that history was written 54 years ago when four black university students in North Carolina sat down at a whites-only lunch counter to order lunch. A 10-year-old civil rights movement was reignited when the man behind the counter refused to serve them. In today's episode, VOA's Chris Simpkins reports from Greensboro, North Carolina.
The International Civil Rights Center and Museum in Greensboro, North Carolina is now open.
Hundreds of people gathered at a former Woolworth department store to pay tribute to what happened here 50 years ago.
I will not rest.
Inspired by civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., four black college students walked into a Woolworth store in Greensboro, North Carolina on February 1, 1960. They sat down at the whites-only lunch counter, but were denied service because of their skin color.
In our hearts, we all thought that racial segregation was an evil.
Joseph McNeil was just 17 years old when he and his friends refused to leave the segregated counter. At the time, they could have been arrested for breaking so-called Jim Crow laws that were enacted to keep blacks and whites separated at public places such as theaters, hotels, and restaurants.
We had to be arrested for a week or one day or 2 months or 3 months. We felt that what we were trying to do was worth it to do that, to make that statement and to defy racial segregation.
Franklin McCain says he was driven to participate in the sit-ins because of the discrimination that surrounded him.
I was quite ready to do something to seek relief, to seek a spot of dignity, humanity, and my manhood. Unfortunately, I met three other guys who felt the same way.
Jabril Kazan from Greensboro remembers what the white waitress told them.
What do you boys want? And we said, we'd like to be served, please, very politely. And she said, you boys know we don't serve colored people here. There's a lunch counter for you over there. Stand-up counter. And we said, thank you, ma'am. We'd rather sit here.
Days later, and tired of the discriminatory practices, more blacks, even some white people, got involved in the sit-in movement. Joseph McNeil says at one point, more than 500 students jammed the lunch counters at Woolworth and other stores with segregated lunch counters.
So our part was starting this thing and getting it done, but not just that, but keeping up the commitment. Keep coming back day after day as we'd promised the stores that we would do if they didn't open the counters to everybody.
Longtime civil rights activist Julian Bond says the Greensboro sit-ins changed the course of the civil rights movement during the 1960s.
And it injected a degree of activism in the civil rights movement, which until then had been largely confined to activism in the courts. All of a sudden, activism in the streets became part of the arena, part of the weaponry that the movement used, and that just changed everything.
In July 1960, and after $200,000 in lost business, Woolworth agreed to integrate its store, allowing blacks to be served at the lunch counter. Historian Lonnie Bunch says the Greensboro campaign was not the first, but it did capture national media attention and spark hundreds of similar nonviolent protests across the country.
So celebrating the Greensboro sit-in really tells us that we're celebrating the sit-ins that occurred in other parts of the South, in other cities throughout the North.
Jabril Kazan says he's honored to have a place in history, but gives credit to the wisdom of his ancestors.
And we just happen to be blessed to be the four that did this, and it caught fire throughout the country. But all things are possible if we only believe. That's what I was taught.
On the 50th anniversary of the Greensboro sit-ins, a new chapter in the history of the civil rights movement has begun with a new International Civil Rights Museum. Community leaders want it to be a lasting tribute to the sacrifices so many African Americans made for equality and social justice. Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Greensboro, North Carolina.
First-time visitors to Uganda might find it strange to hear someone ordering a Rolex at a food stall or picking up a phone saying that they're beeping someone. To make it easier to understand the so-called Ugandan English or Uglish, researcher and linguist Bernard Sabiti published a small dictionary. Sergio Rosbold in Kampala spoke to Sabiti about the origins of the funniest words and tells us more.
In Uganda, when someone refers to a dentist, it's not necessarily someone who fixes your teeth, because that is what can be called a gold digger. Or what about having live sex? Well, in Ugandan English, this means to have unprotected sex. To make life easier for those who are not familiar with Ugandan English or Uglish, a small dictionary might be very helpful. That is why linguist Bernard Sabiti compiled one and explains what motivated him.
There are certain periods when Ugandans coin words, and one of those are the election seasons. You know, there are politicians here whose entire vocabulary almost is Uglish. And they are very successful people in this country who cannot actually use the standard English. So at first I thought, you know, why don't I actually do something about this and let the outside world know why we speak the way they do?
So from the merchant on the street to high-level politicians, nearly everybody in Uganda uses Uglish, says Sabiti.
There are over 40 languages spoken in this country and over 60 ethnic groups. So you find that, you know, every small group takes up the English language and make it their own, and you end up with a very unique, some people call strange, variety of English.
So what are some of the strange things Ugandans say?
When a Ugandan has not seen you for a while, like we are meeting after a long time, the first thing I tell you is that you are lost. It doesn't mean that you are in a wrong place. It simply means I haven't seen you in a while.
But does everybody speak the same Uglish? A random sampling here on the streets of Kampala would suggest maybe not.
If I would say you are lost, what would that mean in Ugandan English?
Ugandan English, it would mean... No, not really. Yeah.
You're lost, it means...
In case you've taken long to see someone, it means you're lost.
And what's a Rolex?
A mixture of chapati and eggs. It's just chapati fried, eggs fried, and then they're rolled into a chapati to make that whole thing of roll eggs.
And that may be why there is a popular saying in Uganda, if you want to hide a treasure, hide it in a book. Despite this, Sabiti says he does not think that Yuglish will ever replace formal English. But he does predict, with election season coming up soon in Uganda, Yuglish will gain a few more expressions. Serginho Roseblatt for VOA News, Kampala.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Terrorist groups need a steady influx of money in order to carry out their deadly agendas. So it makes sense to prevent terrorists from raising funds and using the assets they already possess. This is particularly true of ISIL. ISIL primarily supports itself through criminal activity, including robbing banks and receiving ransoms for kidnapped victims, and extorting from individuals and businesses and raiding villages and towns. It also sells oil stolen from oil fields under its control and raises funds externally from donations. ISIL receives some money from outside donors, but that pales in comparison to their self-funding through criminal and terrorist activities. Today, ISIL controls more territory than al-Qaeda ever has, which means it has access to money and resources on an unprecedented scale. These funds are the lifeblood of its campaign of brutality, said Special Envoy Amos Hochstein. Deputy Assistant Secretary for Terrorist Financing Jennifer Fowler said, last year ISIL may have earned as much as several million dollars per week, or $100 million in total, from the sale of oil and oil products to local smugglers, who in turn sell them to regional actors, notably the Assad regime. The international coalition has taken numerous steps to trim ISIL's profits. First, they are shutting the terrorists out of the global financial network by preventing banks in ISIL-controlled territory from conducting transactions through the domestic or international financial system. To choke off the amount of oil ISIL can bring to market, coalition airstrikes are targeting ISIL-held oil fields and refineries. Also, Turkish and Kurdish authorities are focused on seizing oil that makes it out of ISIL-held territory. The United States is also working with its partners to adopt a no-concessions policy with respect to ransom payments for kidnapping. And we are working with partners in the Gulf to disrupt the flow of donations to all terrorist groups. In the future, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Fowler, we will disrupt the movement of supplies and oil to and from ISIL-controlled territory, prevent unregulated financial companies from providing support to ISIL, target the financial activities of foreign terrorist fighters going to Iraq and Syria, and work with our partners to develop a common approach to countering ISIL's financial activities. Just like any commercial enterprise whose income is less than its expenses, ISIL's financial strength will diminish unless it is able to find alternative sources of revenue or take additional territory, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Fowler. The international coalition is working diligently toward this goal.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals